the air. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. And we have to do make it quick because I have to get out of here. Thank you.
Okay. Continue on that same topic. I think one of the things you're not considering is the fact that the FBI actually used the two people against each other for some of the facts that came out, which was not even shown properly in the Spike Lee's movie.
Let me kind of cut to the chase. And whose fault is that?
Well, listen, one second.
Yeah, I don't have forever.
No. The point is they use black people just like Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell. They don't always just use white people to kill us. They will use their Uncle Tom in the nation itself. And they pay for money.
Okay. Wait, please. Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello. The FBI used Uncle Tom's to kill Malcolm X.
Yeah.
These Uncle Toms are what? Black? White? Asian? What?
Just like in Haiti, Papa Doc and all those.
No. What I'm trying to get across, you know, is I don't care what then this black man's politics were in a sense. I'm saying that it is black men who kill Malcolm X. That is what I'm saying. I don't care if...
It wasn't the black race that did it. It was one black man.
What did I say?
No, but it's like in any country.
What did I say? Come on.
But I don't see the point of laboring the fact that...
You don't see it. I see it. Because I'm saying that too often what we do instead of taking that responsibility and understanding what it means, we brush it off and say, oh, no, it was an FBI plan. It was a CIA plan. It was a whatever.
I'm not saying that I agree with the black man.
Hello.
We lessen the weight of what the
hello,
FBI did.
Hello.
Yeah.
We have to pick this up another time because I do have to go. And thank you very much. Bye bye.
All right, more time.
Bye bye. And we can, as I say, catch up with stuff at 5 o'clock. It's a couple of minutes before then. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. And a reminder. You can go to the website about the bill that Jabi spoke about, or you can do one better. Right now, you can call the Capitol switchboard and make mention of your opposition to bill. It is S3002. That is S3002. And the switchboard number is 202-224-3121. I'll repeat, 202-224-3121. Again, that is to state your opposition to S3002. And again, the number 202-224-3121. Thank you so very much for listening. Again, stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund, which comes up, as I say, right after this. You've been listening to Labrish. My name is Haptah Selassie. We'll be back next week with another edition of the program. Labrish is produced by Ian Forrest with assistance from Suduzo Kaim Billy and Izade Jazzmat Production. Remember to tell the people whom you love that you love them and show affection. With love, we'll find unity and strength. One love, walk good. Mr. Tosh.
Got to build our love on one foundation. Got to build our love. No love at all. There will never be no love at all. I've got to put aside name segregation. I've got to put aside name organization. I've got to put aside. never be no love at all. I mean, there will never be no love at all. So build up a love on one foundation. Come, let us build our love on one solid foundation. Got to build our love on one foundation.
Morgan. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning on recording from exactly a month ago, Tobias Bukel, wonderful writer, interesting guy, fascinating person. You are listening to the Caribbean stuff. We're staying in the Caribbean. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Time Steps by Walter Carlos, or Wendy Carlos. I'm not sure which it was. I think it was Walter Carlos when it was composed for the soundtrack for the motion picture A Clockwork Orange. But Walter Carlos had an operation and became Wendy Carlos about that time, so I'm not really sure which of the two was responsible. I think maybe Walter Carlos wrote the composition, and by the time the record came out, he was she. But it doesn't matter. Carlos is a fabulous, great composer. I'm sure you all remember, the Switched on Bach series of albums. He was, a huge deal at the time. And I was always very fond of his original compositions, and they are hard to find because you had the soundtrack album of A Clockwork Orange, but what was very hard to find that I had only on vinyl for many, many years was an album that was music composed for A Clockwork Orange rather than being the soundtrack album. Rather, this was Wendy Carlos's album of the compositions that were created for that. And I had it in vinyl, and in a flood at WBAI, when we were still in the church on 62nd Street, that album got marred, and I still have it, but it's somewhat unplayable. But Terrence Taylor, brilliant, fabulous writer, who's been on the show a few times, and whose new novel, Blood Pressure, I should mention, is just out. For those of you who are into vampire novels and are looking, in fact, for black vampire novels, well, Terrence Taylor is the way to go. Actually, L.A. Banks is another. Her stuff is more like, the 15-volume series of adventures and stuff and are closer to popular fiction. Terrence's stuff is dark and gory and bloody. And anyway, he got me. He found his vinyl copy and turned it into a media file for me, since I had paid for my original copy. It's all legal, and, you know, we pay for the right to put it on the air, and apparently now even the internet. So, at least stream it on the internet. So, thank you, Terrence. He's doing a lot of readings in the next couple of months, so look around. I think he's doing a reading at Human Books up in Harlem next week. He's going to be at KGB, not this month, but next month in May. But doesn't matter. Terrence is a neat guy, and I have to call him because we have to go shopping. He and I shop together a lot. We go to Fairway. Anyway, which is like a three-hour ordeal, as you can imagine. Before that, before Time Steps, from music composed for Clockwork Orange, we heard another soundtrack piece, the theme music for this program, The Space Fleet by Peter Schickele, music from the soundtrack of the motion picture Silent Running, the music that has served as the theme for this radio program since 1972, when Margot Adler founded the show, and yes, chose, actually, we were together in a 69-cent store, there's something that doesn't exist anymore, and found the album in, one of their bins for 69 cents. She loved the movie, and we got the album, but primarily she, because it was her show, chose that music for the theme of Hour of the Wolf. And such it still is. So, this morning, on the aforementioned Hour of the Wolf. Let's see, announcements. What announcements do I have? Yes, if you are in England, and of course, since we do stream over the internet, you may actually be listening to this in England. You know that tonight, the new Doctor premieres, the 11th Doctor, Matt Smith, and equally importantly, Stephen Moffat, has taken over the show. He is now, when we did our Chicks Dig Time Lords program 2 weeks ago, they largely refer to him as the showrunner. And yeah, that's an American term. He's the story editor, which means that, I mean, here a showrunner is somebody, you know, is somebody who somebody walks into an office and says, is this consistent? Can we do that? Yeah. In Doctor Who, at least, I don't know about other shows and showrunners, in Doctor Who, the story editor is the be-all and end-all, and all the stories, all the writers are chosen episode by episode, is probably to an extent what a showrunner does here, but they're just that much more intimately involved over there with the conception from beginning to end. So the Reborn series that started in 2005 was, you know, pretty much completely the creation of Russell Davies and, of course, the producer, Julie Gardner. I don't know who the new producer is, but the new showrunner, the new story editor of the series, is Stephen Moffat, who probably wrote the best episodes of Doctor Who in the last 5 years. And that would include The Doctor Dances and The Empty Child, which introduced the character Jack Harkness. That includes Blink, which many consider the best of the best single episode of the last 5 years. And, Silence in the Library, which, while it had problems, introduced a great character, Professor Riversong, as played by Alex Kingston. And, the episode, I don't remember what it was called, the one with Madame Pompadour. I mean, he wrote some really, really great stuff. And so we will see. I've watched, you know, the various interviews with the new Doctor and all that. And it is, of course, somewhat overhyped. I do like the new logo. I understand they've made changes to the TARDIS. Don't know what. All this will be available with commercials in the United States on BBC America come April 17th. So apparently, I guess the SIFI channel didn't decide that it was worth their while, so the BBC put it on BBC America. So this is a lot better than it used to be. It used to be that you had to wait, like, you know, 8 months or so after the British broadcast, and then it would be here. Although they did in the last season, the final, it wasn't really a season, the specials with David Tennant, they did show them almost immediately after. But it'll be about a 2-week delay here. But tonight in England, the new Doctor, Matt Smith, premieres. So, they're 5 hours ahead. In about 7 hours, we'll all know what people think of it, if it lives up to any of the hype or not. And forget just the fan kids. Okay, other announcement. This coming Tuesday, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will feature a troika of incredibly brilliant, incredibly fine young adult fantasy writers. And this is not quite what they used to call juveniles, you know, like the Heinlein juveniles. The YA field has become probably the strongest movement in the last 10 or 15 years in literature, probably largely thanks to Harry Potter. And I love YA stuff. You know, it's not just family reading, and indeed a lot of it can be very dark, and there can be a lot of sex in YA books. There's lots of gay YA stuff. There's all kinds of young adult books out there. But young adult fantasy, for me, is where a lot of it is at. And for Carol Cooper, who's a former curator of the reading series, this being our 20th anniversary season, Carol, I'm having all the different curators in a row do their bit one a month. This last month was Joe Monti. We'll hear more about that in a minute. But this month, this time, this coming Tuesday, to be precise, will be Carol. And Carol's a neat and wonderful person. What are her current, looking at her bio, talent scout for 3 different record labels in the 80s and 90s, that's not current. The East Coast Director of Black Music, A&R for A&M Records, National Director of Black Music at CBS Sony. I mean, you know, cool stuff. And Carol, like everybody in the world, is a Clarion graduate. Anybody in the world who means anything in science fiction. And she has booked for us, in alphabetical order, alphabetical by last name, actually by first name as well, Barry Liga, Marie Rutowski, and Robin Wasserman. And I'll just read their bios quickly. Barry Liga graduated from Yale with a degree in English and worked in the comic book industry for 10 years. He wrote comics for part of that time, was responsible for spearheading and developing Free Comic Book Day, the comics industry-wide promotion. Carol's heavily into that comic stuff. During those years, he was a spokesperson for the industry in general, quoted in countless newspaper and magazine articles. In 2006, he launched his career as a YA author with The Astonishing Adventures of Fanboy and Goth Girl, and has gone on to publish a diverse range of teen-oriented novels, including the sequel to his debut entitled Goth Girl Rising. Then Marie Rutowski, these are all very, very literate people, earned a degree in English from the University of Iowa, followed by 6 months' stay in Prague, went on to get her PhD from Harvard in 2006. She says, oh, great, we're going to have a Yale and a Harvard. Oh, my God. Okay. So everybody who comes to the reading, we're going to have the Yaleys on one side of the room and the Have It people on the other side. And then, you know, everybody who's there for Robin Wasserman can hang out with me. Okay, so let's see. She spent that summer furiously writing her first YA novel, The Cabinet of Wonders. Oh, what a wonderful book The Cabinet of Wonders is. You will see. You will see. And the sequel to that is just coming out this month. A steampunky science fantasy about a girl named Petra Kronos and the dangerous secret behind her father's astronomical clock. Then our third reader is Robin Wasserman, who wrote the SF Null, as Carol puts it, YA series, spearheaded by Skinned, a book about the difficult post-human life of a teen accident victim who's given an artificial body to save her life. Robin was raised in suburban Philly, got a degree in the history of science before she became a... We don't have anybody without degrees. You know, I didn't finish high school. These people all have degrees. Before she became a published novelist, she used to sell children's books about which she says, "This is why I now know more about Dragon Ball Z, Pokemon, Scooby-Doo, and Bionicle than anybody over the age of 10 should know." So anyhow, anybody who knows anything about the YA field and about really fun, good, interesting things in that field know that these are three of the absolute best and most entertaining people in that area. So I urge you, come down to our reading series. Admission is free. Actually, admission, we ask for a donation on the way in. But if you don't have it, you just come in anyway. So technically, admission is free. I'll just look at you with, you know, I'll try to do puppy dog eyes as much as I can because we use the money to buy dinner for the readers. So, yeah. Try to give the suggested donation on the way in, but if you can't, please come anyway, okay? That's sort of how it works. Oh, where is it? It's, well, of course, it's at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, our new home. Which is located at 130, I don't know it by heart yet, it's that new to us. We're at 138 Sullivan Street between Houston and Prince Streets in Soho. And it's Tuesday. The event starts at 7 o'clock. We can get crowded, so I suggest show up at 6:30, which is when I'll officially open the doors. And for more information, let's see, go to ourwolf.com and follow the links to the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. Although, actually, Facebook is even better for this. If you're a member of Facebook, look up the New York Review for Science Fiction Reading Series or the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, and either of them will give you all the information you need. Or you can actually go to my blog on LiveJournal. That's another place to go get it. My site is a little bit out of date. It will be updated real soon now. Okay, so that's this Tuesday. Last month, Joe Monti, who was curator for a couple of years, brought Toby Pukkel. Tobias Pukkel is a wonderful, great writer. And I just realized, gee, I'd better move along. Because we have an hour-long interview followed by a reading. If we're going to get that all in, I ought to shut up. Joe brought in Toby partly for this reading, and I had the fascinating, wonderful honor to interview Toby the morning of that reading at the New York Review of Science Fiction reading. So first, we're going to hear that interview that I conducted on, just a tiny bit over a month ago, on March 2nd. And then we're going to hear his reading, which is, alas, all too brief. With intro and outro, the whole thing runs 9 minutes. But we will, but first, we're going to hear the raw, unedited, hopefully all broadcastable interview with Toby. And as I was setting up the mic, I started talking to him about people from Ohio. Now, you're going to learn that while Toby Pukkel comes from Ohio today, well, that is not at all where his story started. I promised you a Caribbean-based writer And despite all sounds, that is exactly what you're going to be getting. So, unedited, raw tape, if it were tape, it's digital, of course. I know, you know, set your Wayback Machine for March 2nd, 2010. And as I stole from Simon, the year 10. And I'll be talking with Tobias Bukel. Oh, you know what? I don't introduce him there. I better introduce him now. Tobias S. Bukel is a Caribbean-born speculative fiction writer who grew up in Grenada, the British Virgin Islands, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. He started submitting and writing short stories while in high school. In 1999, he attended the Clarion, I told you we'd hear that again, Clarion Science Fiction and Fantasy Workshop, and sold his first story, Fish Merchant, to Science Fiction Age, Scott Edelman, shortly afterwards. About the time of the sale, his story, In Orbit Medieval, Lee, won a quarterly contest for the Writers of the Future. Well, that he's going to talk about in the interview. Since then, his stories have appeared in a variety of places, including Analog and Nature, the anthology's New Voices in Science Fiction, Men Writing Science Fiction as Women, and So Long Been Dreaming. His first short story collection, Tides from the New Worlds, was published by Wyrm, W-Y-R-M, Publishing in April 2009. His novels include Crystal Rain, Ragamuffin, which was nominated for the Nebula Award, and his latest book is Sly Mongoose. And he's well known for one of the original bloggers, working for Weblogs, Inc. The word weblog became the word blog. Well, we're going to talk about that in detail. So, now, set that Wayback Machine, and let's tune in as I am preparing the interview. Good cons? I went, there was OctoCon.
As I said, we were talking about Ohio as I was setting up the mic.
Oh, I know that song.
Yeah, okay.
Anymore.
Context is they bill themselves as Ohio's ReaderCon.
Oh,
and that's a very fun convention.
Really?
I'm actually going to be the guest of honor in April.
Oh, cool.
Or not in April, in August.
I'm only doing about two or three cons a year, one of which is ReaderCon.
Okay.
And I'm looking for other conventions, and anything that says it's like ReaderCon is an attraction to me. And Ohio is hollering distance.
I've never actually been to ReaderCon, so I can't compare the two. But
ReaderCon is good, but the name says it all.
Context is there. There's a MarCon is held in Columbus.
That's right, yeah. I know that from the flyers I see.
Yeah. What else is...
I'm not an active fan anymore, all to my benefit. There was a year where I attended over 40 conventions. I have since then found sanity.
MillenniaCon is later this year, and that's another convention that's held in Cincinnati, or just north of Cincinnati. And MillenniaCon is usually gets, you know, some Ohio authors.
Yeah. And so we're actually recording. We should probably actually...
Whenever you're ready,
I guess I'm... whenever I'm ready, we don't have enough time for that.
All right, let's go.
So let me slate it by saying that today is March 2nd of the year 10, and I am in a secret, undisclosed location in Brooklyn. Not my house in Brooklyn, where I've done a number of interviews,
mm-hmm.
But in a very slopish area, and we won't go beyond that.
Okay.
because we don't want to give away too much geosync information. But with me is Tobias Bukel. Am I saying it correctly?
Yeah, it's Tobias Bukel. Yes.
Okay, yeah. That seemed correct. And this is, like, very cool to have you here.
Thank you very much.
When I heard that Joe Monti had booked you for the Nearsif readings, I was thrilled, actually.
Cool.
And you were a name that had not been on my radar as somebody who could make it to the reading center.
Oh, I come out once a year or so, but usually it's, you know, I come out and meet with, you know, my editors and agents and whatnot, so it was cool to be invited to do a reading.
well, in the future we'll have to consider readings and perhaps... if we can work it out, a live radio show.
Of course.
So that the listeners can talk back and or ask back.
Ask back.
I'll keep them on good behavior.
Toby Bukel is a blogger, a novelist, a short story writer, what to fill in the blanks here?
Professional troublemaker? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, all those things do add up, especially yes. with the blogging part.
Yeah, the blogging sort of is a big umbrella, but, you know, I do some freelance writing, nonfiction, all that sort of stuff, whatever keeps food on the table.
Yeah, and we should mention, I mean, it's one, you know, but people call themselves bloggers.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me, I'm going to cut this out.
Okay.
Pardon.
Mm-hmm.
People call themselves bloggers, and yeah, anybody can be a blogger. It's not like you've got an editor. You're a professional blogger. You started in about 1999?
Yeah, well, in 1998, actually, when GeoCities first came out, I started experimenting with the idea of sort of like, back then it was called online journaling.
Yeah, nobody had the concept of web logs.
Right. They may have had...
I should mention I was on CompuServe in the early 80s.
Okay, heritage than I do.
I was a CompuServe whiz-op. I mean, yeah. I go back.
Well, I was in college, and one of the things we've been asked to do was incorporate some technology into our creative writing portfolio, and I created a GeoCities website, you know, with what I was trying to do. You know, I was going to be a writer, and it included some samples of my poetry, and I sort of got frustrated with all the other pages that were out there that were just very static business card type things. You know, I thought, it's way more interesting if you provide content, and so I started to keep an online journal, quote-unquote, in 1998, of my path towards becoming a published writer. It was sort of the whole shtick was, you know, one day I'm going to figure out how to become a published writer. This is what I want to do with my life. And here's my journey. You can follow along. And, you know, acquired a lot of followers that way. And, you know, as I sold short stories and moved along in the process, acquired even more. In 2006, I was actually laid off from being in charge of a college's educational technology. And when I was laid off, I had enough experience blogging and you know, doing nonfiction work and whatnot. I just thought that would be an interesting path to take my career down. So I began to work for a lot of companies doing professional blogging, which is, you know, they'd give me a subject and I would write blog posts for them for money, which in 2006 even was kind of a weird idea. I remember my mother-in-law, when my wife told her that, you know, Toby's making half of his income from blogging, she waited until I was out of the room and then leaned over and whispered to my wife, "Is that okay? Is that a good thing?"
Yeah. and it's questionable, you know. I have a tendency to, with one sweep, put down bloggers because most aren't professional. Most are self-appointed. It's vanity press.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, most people are, you know, not making a living at it. There are the exceptions, and within the SF community, although they're not doing it about SF, but Catherine Kramer, for example,
right,
is a professional blogger, and a right. few other people. And I'm not a blogger. I write articles about technology,
mm-hmm.
and they end up on people's blogs, but that's a whole different thing. I'm writing for...
Right.
magazines, which may or may not have a print outlet.
Right, and that's increasingly become how I kind of view it. You know, it's just another form of freelancing, just different yeah. medium. But it was really cool, you know, to just put professional blogger on your curriculum vitae.
And that's the thing, a professional blogger is way cool. I get annoyed when I'm at a tech event,
uh-huh.
and there are people looking for the free equipment and all the wonderful handouts mm. that, yes, I go for as well. I mean, you can't get enough thumb drives. bigger stuff you have to give back. The other bloggers don't. Bloggers take entire systems from Microsoft at CES. They did. That was 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, in order to show people Windows 7,
mm-hmm.
they gave them entire computers to keep.
Mm.
And you know, no professional blogger, or at least nobody working for a magazine, an outlet, would keep such a machine. You take it, you give it back a month or two later. Mm-hmm. That's my thing about bloggers.
Okay.
But that's just me talking. We're not here to talk to me. I do this weekly. But I was actually trying to do a sort of an agenda, because the blogging sort of comes first with 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And 1999, is when you go to Clarion.
Yeah, 1999, I attended the Clarion Science Fiction Fantasy Workshop. I've been writing short fiction since I was 15. My first submission was to the Writers of the Future contest when I was living in the Caribbean on a boat.
Yeah, we're going to roll back to that.
Sure. And I just, found the contest rules in the very back and was, it was the first time I figured out how to follow the guidelines and send something in and got my very first rejection back. And over the years had been, working on the craft and whatnot, and went to college to get a creative writing degree and try and figure out how you became a writer. Unfortunately, a academic degree doesn't tell you anything about the business, so halfway through college I suddenly realized I was going to have to find an alternate means of educating myself, and found out, thanks to the fact that I was on a blog, was interfacing with other writers who were keeping blogs. Mm-hmm. And in 1998, the people who went to Clarion first started keeping online journals about the experience. There were a handful of writers who went to the Clarion the year before.
Who were some of those people? I'm curious.
Diana Rowland is one who leaps to memory.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that she was 98. And Tamela Viglione was another. And their blogs about the entire experience of Clarion kind of got me all hep to go, very excited about the whole thing. So in 1999, I applied. I was a junior in college and, sent some short stories out and, filled out the application, got accepted. Big deal. I mean, it was really cool because it now allowed me to plug into the whole writer community. I'd never met other writers, even other working writers, and the ability to do that and learn off of,
everyone around. Clarion is a wonderful, life-changing experience. Although there's a story which I won't repeat right now, but I got this radio show because I didn't go to Clarion.
Mm-hmm.
In 19, so I have the choice to go to Clarion West,
okay,
or take over Hour of the Wolf from Margot Adler,
okay,
who I'm hoping, by the way, will be at the reading tonight.
Oh, very
and
cool.
And I took the radio show.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, it's as life-changing as you want it to be. I mean, for me, it was one of those things where I was like, I just wanted to go and learn all these things from these authors. There would be authors who'd be there to teach, and I just wanted to, sort of suck their minds dry, in a polite and academic way. And there was also going to be an editor, that was Scott Edelman of Science Fiction Age at the time, and he was there for a weekend, and I wanted to, talk to him about, like, how he went about acquiring short fiction, like, what it is that he saw that would make him jump to buy a story. And, learning all that stuff. Tim Powers was one of my instructors, and, mm-hmm. and he's fantastic. And Karen Joy Fowler.
Good people.
Mike Resnick is extraordinarily versed in the business.
And he's also an editor, so you had the advantage, really, of two editors.
Two editors, exactly.
For the price of one.
James Morrow was our first week instructor. And so you just, these become your teachers, and you have a tremendous amount of opportunity to learn if you're willing. And that was really valuable to me. And it enabled me to kind of figure out some of the next steps that I wasn't too sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Mike Resnick actually said something at the time, which is that he didn't think that the Clarion was make or break, but he's like, it could shave 50% off of the time you needed to be in your journeyman phase, after he taught there and saw what we were doing, And I think that's about right. I think if I hadn't have gone, it probably would have taken me another year or two to make my first sale to a magazine. I was on my way there. I had the basics, but going there kind of gave me the tools I needed to kind of accelerate that whole process.
Yeah, and also brought you into a community that a lot of people don't necessarily join, but they are different. And some would say better for having joined it, at least having the choice whether or not to get into a professional community, mm-hmm. may God help us all, Fanish community, whatever.
Well, for me, the
you're not isolated.
Yeah, the professional community support was the big thing. Particularly, not even the professional community, but creating peers. So what happened was, I left Clarion with four or five really good writer friends that I kept in close touch with after I left by email.
Mm-hmm.
And we would talk to each other, talk about what we were learning, and just keep that process of discovery and education alive. And that I think is really important, to sort of have a cohort,
Yeah, and it's interesting. All the people, doing this show for this many years,
mm-hmm.
having interviewed so many writers through the years, I think there are three that didn't go to Clarion. Oh. And I mean, it's just astounding. Hmm. And it says something. And but one of the things I've also noticed is the bond that the various writers have with their classmates of that year, and it becomes, in modern language, their crib mates.
Yeah. No, I mean, it does create, you do create some very good friends, because it's, you know, I never used to understand when I watched, occasionally you'd see a reality TV show, and you'd just wonder, how can these people go so insane, you know, in that environment? I mean, don't they realize there's a larger world outside? But, you know, when you spend 6 weeks surrounded by the same small group of people, all focused on the same thing, you kind of just completely forget that there's a greater outside world.
I'm thinking, yeah, you're talking like that, and my associate, Margot Adler, who created Hour of the Wolf, her year was Ellison,
uh-huh.
Spinrad, Chip Delaney, Joanna Russ, Le Guin, and I forget who. They didn't do an editor in that year. Somebody else.
Quite a writer lineup.
Ted Sturgeon.
Okay.
Yeah. And quite a, but also, let's think about some of the personalities here.
Right.
Ellison, yeah, and Damon Knight and Kate Wilhelm, of course, were still presiding.
Right, they did the anchor.
Exactly. They did the anchor. And so I'm, the idea of being in a closed environment, and I think they were on a campus. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, there wasn't anything else going on that campus. It was during an off time of year for the school.
Yeah. It creates a very sort of monastic environment for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know. So, yeah, it's a very intense experience, but it was very good. I picked up a lot of tools, you know, going out of it. And I think I was able to sort of shorten my time to print. 3 or 4 months after leaving Clarion, I made my first sale to Scott Edelman, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And
at what publication was that?
Science Fiction Age. I was in the second to last issue before it folded.
Right.
Because, yes, yeah, Scott Edelman was fantastic. He really he had a talent for spotting what I was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that really, really fascinating. And then 3 months after that, I sold two more. You know, I finally broke Writers of the Future, the competition, and sold a story to them. And sold a short story to Nalo Hopkinson, and that kind of, you know.
Right. I think that was actually where I first read you.
Okay.
Was in which anthology?
Whispers from the Cotton Tree Root. Yeah. And that's where I kind of launched, you know, that's where my career started, you know, bloomed from, was those three kind of initial appearances.
Yeah. And and there's sort of a Caribbean thing happening there, isn't there?
Yes, that's kind of... So, well, I mean, the fascinating thing about Nalo Hopkinson for me was that after getting back from Clarion, her name had been mentioned a few times to me by particularly Tim Powers when we had a meeting. He was talking about my fiction, and he was like, you know, at the time I wasn't sure, you know, I didn't have all my elements together for what I wanted to be as a writer. And I was still experimenting a lot in short fiction. One of the things I was doing some of the time was bringing in these Caribbean elements and didn't have a lot of self-confidence about it because I wasn't sure if it would be welcomed in science fiction because I didn't see a lot of that in science fiction. You know, and the weird sense of just, you know, what kind of path. Yeah, I just didn't know how to go about it. And Tim Powers and Karen Joy Fowler and Mike Resnick actually really encouraged me to kind of keep doing more of that. And then I was playing around with that after Clarion a lot more than I was before Clarion. And, you know, so they'd said, you know, Nalo Hopkinson, you should look up her name. And then I finally, like, you know, 2 or 3 months after Clarion or some point, I forget when it was, I actually looked up her name. You know, like, oh yeah, Tim Powers marked on this manuscript, I should look her up. So I looked her up online and saw that her book title was... For the first one was Brown Girl in the Ring, which mm-hmm. is the title of a very it's a Caribbean kids song. You sing it and do it kind of like a dance with it. And the moment I saw the title, I thought, oh, she's from the Caribbean. That's why they kept mentioning her name to me. They're like, oh, you should read Nalo Hopkinson all the time. I'm kind of like, why? I don't.
And
understand.
Her father was a teacher in the Caribbean of Shakespearean things.
Her father, yeah.
Her father's a major, wonderful figure.
Right. And so, like, I finally saw Nallo's title.
And also very Caribbean-oriented.
Right. And immediately emailed Nallo, because I was like, oh my gosh, you're writing Caribbean science fiction. That's what I'm trying to do, you know, with some of my things. And this is fantastic. I'm so excited. And she wrote back. She's like, oh, I happen to be putting together this anthology of Caribbean fantastic fiction. And she says, do you have anything? And at the time, actually, I'd submitted all of my Caribbean fantastic fiction out to markets, so I couldn't give her anything.
Mm.
So I told her, well, you know, I have something, but it's not quite finished. How many days can you give me so I can touch it up and send it to you? And she said, well, I'm closing the anthology, like, in 2 days.
Oh,
you know,
God.
So if you can get that story to me in 2 days, she's like, I'd love to take a look at it. So I sat down and wrote the story that night. You know, after dinner, after I got that email, I immediately sat down and wrote it. And then I gave it to my wife and to one of my professors for first reads,
mm-hmm.
and revised it and then submitted it to her. And she accepted it. And I was so jazzed. And then I felt so guilty about having fudged the truth that I actually emailed her afterwards. And I'm like, I don't know if this changes your mind, but I have a confession to make.
Yeah, well, and but anybody who knows how Nallo is just like way cool.
Yeah. She's
wonderful.
She's good people. And it was her friendship to me was tremendously valuable to give me the confidence to go ahead and write more of what I wanted to write over the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, she was incredible to meet, even virtually. I mean, mostly email correspondence. But, yeah, it was wonderful.
Yeah, and she was a little bit ahead of the curve online, as it were. I've been around online and science fiction for a long time. I just remember when there was a whole period of time when you couldn't get science fiction writers to come online and
uh-huh.
to talk. And when they did, they chose the worst services available, the worst bulletin board systems and things. And we were giving away, I was at, not CompuServe, but ZipNet. But working with people at CompuServe and working through a few people, I'd get free accounts. Mm-hmm. Anybody told me, you're a science fiction writer? Free CompuServe account. Can't do much better than that. but they were going on to Genie, which is run by General Electric, GENE.
Okay.
It was a mainframe, and great people, the world's worst interface.
Okay.
And why these forward-seeking people couldn't, A, get computers,
mm-hmm.
B, couldn't get online, couldn't get, and by get, I'm wiggling my fingers, I hope everybody watching the radios understands. it was funny, Nallo and you and a few other people are the next generation who were actually accepting and ahead of the curve there.
I guess so. I mean, I guess everyone's online now, so I don't think much about it. But when I did start doing the blogging about, you know, here's my path to publishing, I had this thing where I'd achieved a fairly high readership at some point because I was ahead of the curve.
Right.
And I had a lot of people noticing what I was doing. That kind of dipped off a little bit once the, you know, 04, 05, people started really coming online and creating better web presences. My traffic actually dipped those years
mm-hmm.
In response, you know, when you know, Neil Gaiman, when Neil Gaiman comes online, a bunch of people sort of disappeared over there like, oh, he's blogging. This is awesome. Maybe that was 2001 he started. He's been doing it for a while. He was mm-hmm. one of the first like huge names I remember getting started when he started blogging his book tour.
Yeah, although I'll point out that before there was any such concept, when I'm an early adopter,
mm-hmm.
I was getting on CompuServe in 81, 82, and BBSs and stuff like that, and every BBS I logged on to, and on CompuServe, everywhere I went, I'd meet online somebody calling himself Uncle Orson.
Okay.
That would be Scott Card.
Right.
And he, I mean, talk about somebody with an early online presence.
Uh-huh.
Like before the beginning, in the 70s, in the bleeping 70s, Orson Scott Card was promoting books and stories and writing about what he was writing about and doing, not blogging, but having conversations
right.
with all kinds of people en masse.
Okay.
Talk about somebody who got it.
Yeah, yeah.
As far as literature, as far as online was concerned.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's incredible. I mean, I didn't really. I remember. I mean, I'm fairly young. I was born in '79, and so my first encounter with the whole online experience was when I was in St. Thomas. My stepdad was working at a small private school called St. Peter St. Paul, the Catholic school on St. Thomas, and the computer lab director there was just really good at getting grants. And so this was the first place that I knew of that was wired up to the internet. Like, you'd heard about it around, you know, and but I hadn't really seen a dial-up anything until I went in there. And that was pretty wild. I remember, like, when hurricanes would, you know, were on the way, like, my stepdad would bring out would get those little gifts of, like, the, you know, the direction it was going, so we could get the little, you know, animations of where the hurricane had been, where it was coming. And I remember spending a day sitting there when he was doing some work and going through one of the Yahoo categories. Like, I went to yahoo.com and, like, went through an entire category and, like, reached the end of the links and thought, well, that's it. I reached the end of this particular part of the internet.
Yeah. Yep. That's it. There was a site, actually. It's still there somewhere. I don't even remember what the URL was. But it was just, it basically was just a sign saying, you've reached the internet.
Yeah.
You've reached the end of the internet.
Yes.
Thank you for coming.
It's all done now.
It was very Douglas Adams in feel and nature.
It was a big red button or something. Yeah.
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 A restart or something.
It's something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
It was very clever.
It's funny, but I do remember hitting the end of that particular era of the internet when I was, like, you know, flipping through Yahoo, and oh gosh, it must have been like 95, 94, mm-hmm. 94. Yeah. So.
Yeah, which is, I mean, Yahoo's pretty young in 94, and
yeah.
The web only becomes a part of the public in 95.
Yeah.
In August 95 is okay. When the web is no longer a part of the National Science Federation.
Okay.
The NSF. Before that, it was non-commercial. So, Yahoo was, I think they were using Alta Vista for a search engine,
okay.
And they were the place to go to get daily recommendations of new websites.
Right. Yeah, no, that was just one brief encounter for me. I didn't really start paying attention to it until 1997, mm-hmm. which was when
it starts maturing
in college, and
or at least starts being worthwhile.
Started working a computer lab,
yeah.
And you know, had the time to kind of play around and check it out and see what was going on.
So let's roll back to a little before the virtuality of all this.
Okay.
All these Caribbean references are rather unusual for a landlocked writer from Ohio. So let's you were raised in the Caribbean. You had
yeah. Well, my
years.
my grandfather was sort of this technical genius living in London. And that's where my family kind of hails from on my mom's side. And he sold his business designing custom stereos for rich people.
Ooh, okay.
With lots of flashy buttons and lights on them. And took the money, bought a 40-some foot yacht, packed the hold with enough cigarettes to trade for food with for the next few years, and headed off and sailed around the Mediterranean. My mom was born in Middlesex, but most of my aunts and uncles are born throughout different parts of the Mediterranean, from what I understand. And eventually, he sailed onto the Caribbean. And my mom, who'd been going to school in New Zealand at the time, flew out to meet him in Grenada. And they weren't able to meet up. And so my mom, who was 17 or 18 at the time, ended up being stranded on Grenada and made that her home for a long time. My father is from Petit Martinique, which is one of the small little islands off the tip of Grenada. So I'm related to a chunk of Petit Martinique and Carriacou, which are the two little islands off the north side of Grenada. And he's local. He's from, you know, his family all hails from Grenada for quite a while. And I still have relatives down there. And that's why I grew up in Grenada. I grew up on a small boat in Lansipine Harbor on the south end, south tip of Grenada. And left when I was, I think, 9. And my mom rejoined the family in the Virgin Islands, the British Virgin Islands. She and my dad split up, went their separate ways. And that side of the family all still works on boats. My uncle actually lives in Connecticut, where he works on industrial boats, rewiring, mega boats, large tugs, all that sort of stuff, up in a shipyard up there. Does sea trials, all that sort of stuff. My aunt is now in Rhode Island. She owns a boat restoration type business, and my uncle keeps care of boats for rich clients in the British Virgin Islands.
Wow.
So, okay. Yeah, my sister basically ditched Ohio and headed out for the East Coast and found a boat to work on and has been sailing all over the Caribbean and East Coast and places like that for the last 4 years. So, yeah, we definitely have the salt water in our veins. And having grown up in the Caribbean, that's my background. You know, my blood's tied to the islands. I was raised there, you know, and it's a very important part of my background. And I didn't leave till I was 15.
So how would you describe your background, therefore, culturally? Would you give it a name?
Culturally? Well, I'm mixed race, but I look white. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom is British and white. My dad is sort of brown-skinned and from the north end of Grenada.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I've always just identified myself as, you know, mixed-race Caribbean, you know. And
what kind of folk tales would you have?
There's a strong oral tradition.
Oh, well.
Still,
One of the reasons I dote on Caribbean guests of Caribbean extraction, and Nalo, of course, is, right. Hey, it's radio. Oral traditions is what we look for in radio.
Right. Growing up in Grenada, there's still some of that going around, but not as much. I mean, I remember some folk tales, you know, when I was really little. But that was among the older folk. You know, it was dying out a bit even then.
Would it be fair to say that just the existence, the exposure to such folk tales were something that helped spark
that was just part of the cultural background for me. I never thought about it too much when I was younger. What really sparked my desire to be a writer was just the fact that I lived on a boat, and you know, I'm probably one of the few or last generation of writers that you'll meet that grew up without much exposure, if any, to TV when they were young.
Mm.
You know, so I some other writer claimed that a while back, but I was like, due to my own unique circumstances, even though I'm far younger than that writer, I can actually claim the same thing. And so I grew up without a TV, really. And one of the first things my mom did at a really young age to sort of get me out of her hair, she was basically a single mom in all but practice, was to teach me to read really young.
Mm-hmm.
And because I picked up reading somewhere around the age of 4 or 5, a fairly young age, I really loved everything to do with it. You know, I love books, just chewed through books. And so,
name some titles.
You know, the first book I ever read was Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End.
Uh-huh.
That's the first actual book I read.
I was about 8 when I did that, yeah.
Yeah. It was in my dad's. My dad would. He owned a boat that he took day sailors. You know, like you load a bunch of tourists on it and mm-hmm. sail them out to an island nearby and feed them lots of rum punch and ship them back to the cruise ship docks. Right. So he had, you know, everywhere you go on boats, there's always like a little library. You know, because there's no TV, you got to do something to entertain yourself. So pawing around in the books, and I found Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End and just started reading it. And took it back with me and read it, and it just blew my little, you know, 5-year-old mind. I just couldn't believe that this book existed.
Yeah.
You know, it just was wild. All the concepts in there, it was just, it just made me start thinking really differently.
And it's a wonderful thing. A lot of people, I think, you know, this isn't young adult, this isn't a juvenile or
right,
anything.
Right.
But kids reach for that. It doesn't matter that it's over your head, because it's over all of our heads.
Yeah, you know, and basically it's a book that tries to get you thinking, you know, like, what is the, you know, what is man meant for outer space? You know, mm-hmm. could he really exist out there? You know, what is our future? You know, what is it supposed to be, you know? And it just really got me thinking, you know, critically from a very young age about everything, just questioning everything. And I just started, you know, sucking down more books. I read Clive Cussler a lot. Mm-hmm. My mom had those lying around. Used to read a lot of Westerns when I was younger because it was extraordinarily exotic and strange and mysterious.
Yeah, especially if you're living on a boat.
Because I'm living in the Caribbean. I'm living in the tropics. The
people in the West are probably reading about people living in the tropics.
Yeah. No, it makes perfect sense. Loved Zane Grey as a little preteen and would read all that stuff. But science fiction became something I kind of started to specialize in. Out of all my books, it started to grow more and more market share as I found more and more science fiction books. It just sort of became this cycle of growth, and just started really looking for science fiction authors after a certain point because I was just kind of like, these guys really kind of mess my mind up. I love this.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Did you have any exposure to the real oral tradition or audio books or anything?
No audiobooks, and there was this famous guy, and he'd come on the radio every once in a while, who's a storyteller in Grenada, an old school storyteller, and I don't remember who he is or what the details are. I'd love to find out more. But he was a comedian.
I wonder if those tapes are available.
And one of the stories he told was about a cricket game, and I just remember that, and he made lots of jokes based on dialect and stuff like that. And I don't remember all the details. I just remember he'd occasionally be on the radio, and I would tune in and catch it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And people would always tell stories, like, on the, you know... One of the more interesting experiences I had growing up was there was a Rastaman who lived in a little stone cottage on the beach, you know, and he would tell me all sorts of stuff about Rastafarianism, you know, and tell me stories.
By the way, the radio show that precedes mine is a Rasta show.
So. Okay, yeah. And so this was just sort of the environment I grew up in. It was all sorts of people. I'd run into Hindus and Muslims and Rastafarians, as well as, like, you know, your staunch Anglicans and all this stuff. And it just kind of, you know, it's a melange that grows in the back of your head as a kid that this is what life is like. It's lots of interesting things happening. And because I lived on a boat, that cult is a whole separate culture, boat culture. And these people, you know, cruisers sail the world, you know. And so I had a lot of seasonal friends, you know, people who would swim through Grenada during the summer season or swing through Grenada. Yeah, because Grenada is south of the hurricane belt, right? Mm-hmm. So there would be people who would come and friends I would have once a year who'd be there for hurricane season in Grenada, who'd come and anchor in the anchorage, and then they'd head north up the islands after hurricane season.
We're pausing for just a moment to tell you that you're listening to WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and over WBAI.org. And this is an interview that I, Jim Freund, conducted for this show, Hour of the Wolf, on March 2nd, 2010, and I am interviewing the science fiction writer Tobias S. Bukel. And so with that brief interruption, right back to the interview.
So it's just a real interesting childhood to have, you know, to be part of the Caribbean culture, to be part of this nomadic sort of community of people from all over the different parts of the world who lived on boats.
I mean, to me, this story is as exotic as anything I've read in lots of fantasy and science fiction, for that matter. What it really brings to my mind are, like, the Le Guin Earthsea stories in the archipelagos.
Yeah, see, like, I love Le Guin for that reason. That flavor, you know, definitely feels like home to me in some ways. Yeah, it's. I guess it sounds exotic in the retelling, but to me, that's just my base existence, right?
Well, you're talking to me in Brooklyn. I don't get out of here too often, you know. I live near a bay in Brooklyn. That's the water that I get to see.
Well, and, you know, it's just... It was just life, and it had its ups and downs. You mm-hmm. know? But
and now it's but now you live in a landlocked environment.
I do. Well, the summer of 1995 was a really bad hurricane season. We had one really bad tropical storm and two hurricanes come through within a couple weeks of each other.
Mm.
And we went through the first tropical. At the time, my stepdad and my mom had gotten married, and we all lived on a 39-foot fiberglass Pearson boat. Pearson's built right up in Rhode Island, and they made some great cruisers. The 39 Pearson that we were living on had a really great flat deck with lots of room in the inside for the cabins, and made for a great liveaboard. And we've been on that boat for several years, and the third hurricane, you know, we weren't able to get enough warning to be able to go find a place to shelter the boat properly. So we laid down extra ground tackle, and which is anchors and chain, and, you know, secured the boat as best we could. And then for a brief moment, we talked about maybe my stepdad and me staying aboard the boat to ride out the hurricane, because it was being predicted as not being a very strong one. And at the last minute, we kind of decided, you know, wow, the winds are gusting like 60 miles an hour already, and the hurricane's still way away from landfall. So probably not a good idea. So we kind of, I threw on a change of clothes into my backpack and grabbed a manuscript or two that I had printed out and sealed that up and hopped in the dinghy with my mom and stepdad and my little brother and my sister and headed to shore, stayed at a friend's house. And there were like several hundred boats in the anchorage we lived in, you know, the whole community of cruisers live aboard. And, you know, the next day there were like two boats, you know, they'd all just been swept out to sea. And our boat was destroyed, you know, went all the way out to sea. Fortunately, our cat, we had two cats aboard the boat when we had to leave. And we were kind of bummed, you know, to put it lightly, that we had, you know, possibly lost the cats. But the boat was swept all the way out to sea and thrown up onto the rocks on the west side of St. Thomas. So we were able to, you know, get the cats.
Oh, God. Yeah.
But at the time, we were more worried about our friends, because our neighbors, the whole family had stayed aboard the boat. And just up north of them, or not north, but just up upstream from them was a good friend of the family. And so when we were on the VHF radio through the whole storm, the first report we got was that, you know, the boats were slipping, you know, all sorts of boats were losing their anchors and going. And our friend Maggie on the one boat said that her anchor had bounced loose and that she was adrift and then cut off. So we figured she was dead and that the family that lived next door to us was dead. But they actually did the same thing we did. About halfway through the worst of it, they got in a dinghy in like 100-mile-an-hour winds and went to shore. God. And then the house that they got to on shore got flooded, so they had to leave that house. And they went up the road like with galvanized steel flying overhead and whatnot. And they went up to another house, and the roof of that house got ripped off. And they huddled in a corner for the whole night and had hypothermia by the morning. So they had quite a story to tell. And our friend who, her anchors busted loose, they re-anchored halfway down through the anchorage. So she got completely lucky. And they just kept bouncing and bouncing and bouncing and then re-caught. So, the you know, she was completely post-traumatic stress person, you know, when we talked to her the next day. But she was alive. And a lot of other friends went through some very harrowing experiences.
Good God. Yeah.
And so that's why I live in Ohio. we were homeless. we had no home. Our home was tossed 30 feet up onto rocks, you know, and broken. And we rescued the cats. I rescued my computer. And my stepdad hails from Akron. That's where his family lives. And after the storm, my mom was having a medical condition, and there was the medical facilities on the island had been, well, actually, interestingly enough, what had happened was they couldn't get into the hospital because all the cars in a parking lot nearby had been stacked from the storm in front of all the doors. And plus, you know, facilities were kind of ruined. So people, they were triaged out to Puerto Rico if they had an emergency, and if it was a non-emergency but still needed medical condition, they were airlifting you out. So my mom got airlifted out, and they said, pick a U.S. city to get airlifted to. And so she's like, I have family in Akron. So once she was in Akron, my stepdad, you know, got us tickets eventually. 2 weeks later, we were able to get a flight out to Akron to be with mom. And then once we were up there, we got the insurance settlement from losing our boat. And then, you know, once they had the money and they were in Akron, you know, since St. Thomas was still in the process of being rebuilt, they kind of looked for jobs. And then soon, you know, we're living in Ohio.
Yeah.
You know, and I was a senior in high school at the time. So I spent 2 weeks being a senior at my school, you know, that I'd been at for years in St. Thomas, All Saints Cathedral. And then I left that and came to Akron, where I was a senior at, what is the name of that place? Well, that's another school for about four months. And then I had my parents moved again, and I went to another school, Black River High School near Ashland, Ohio. And so I went to three different high schools my senior year, which was a mess. And so after that, you know, I'm stuck in Ohio. I don't have any cash on hand. I don't, you know, the way I used to make a living working for boats, on boats, with boats in the Caribbean from spare cash, you know. And now I'm in Ohio, and I have no idea what teenagers do for money. And the only job I could find was at McDonald's. So, you know, like 2 months after, you know, 2 months into
the working. The culture shock must have my been gosh. Amazing.
You know, and that you needed a car to get everywhere in Ohio. So.
That's something I only learned to drive about 10 years ago. Being a New Yorker, you don't need... There is no car culture here. There's no need for one.
Right.
Somebody is a part of the car culture, and you can tell my neighbor will get into her car to go two blocks to the right. grocery store and come back. I'm going, yeah, and where are you from? This is New York. We don't even here in Brooklyn, you don't do that.
Yeah. No, so it's, you know, I happened to adjust to the fact that I had to get a car, or, you know, just die. Was really tough. And after 2 months of working at McDonald's, I just thought, you know, no one in my family's really gone to college, but I was like, you know, I might as well apply to college because this is horrible. I couldn't get ahead. You know, what I wanted to do was work at McDonald's long enough to get enough cash in hand that I could go back to the islands and figure out what to do, you know, like work on a boat, try and get a captain's license, that sort of thing. And, I just couldn't get ahead because it's like, you know, you got some money saved up and then like the car radiator like blew and it's like, all right, I got to repair the car radiator, you know? And it's like, I could only ever get a couple $100 laid aside. It's like, I can get enough for a plane ticket, but I can't get enough to like get rent to live somewhere for a month when I move back to St. Thomas. So finally I was like, you know what? I'll just apply to college and see if I can figure this out over the next 4 years.
Now, when did you first get... You're already writing at this point. When did you get an inkling that that could be your profession?
You know, the idea was strong in my head when I was 15. That's when I first sent that story off to Writers of the Future, and I started completing short stories for the first time. And that's when I first started telling people that's what I wanted to do with my life. So right at 15, I was kind of like, this is what I want to do. However, I had no idea how to go about it. And so my idea was that, you know, I'd go through high school. You know, for me, the people who went to college were people who had money and connections and things like that. I didn't really think it was something possible for me.
Mm-hmm.
And since all my family are entrepreneurs and whatnot, I just thought, you know, I was going to be an entrepreneur of some sort. And so I really figured that what I'd do was try and find a boat and be a day sail captain and then write in my spare time and figure out how to become a writer. And, you know, the hurricane kind of upset that whole idea. And, you know, so from the age 15 to onward, I was very much kind of had this idea buried in my skull that I was going to become a writer. And that's what I went to college with, you know, just showed up there, was like, I'm here to learn how to become a writer. Anything that gets in the way of that is a problem.
How would you describe your writing for those who aren't yet familiar with your work? What kind of a literary lasso?
A literary lasso?
Yeah.
That's, you know, I love adventure. I really like fast-paced, spicy, adventurous stuff. I read, like I said, you know, when I was a kid, it was Clive Cussler, it was, you know...
Westerns,
you know, so I love that aspect. So, you know, there's that, and then I have, you know, this sort of...
Most SF writers read Westerns, it reflects their writing in a bad way. In yours, it works well.
Well, thank you. You know, so this aesthetic I have is of wanting to be an entertainer. I really do want to entertain people. I don't think many people read my books and leave thinking they were bored. And
that's a fair statement.
That's kind of the one thing I like to do. And I'm always reading things. I'm always looking at how people pace and how people are able to do that. I'm always extraordinary. William Gibson had this comment that I really applied to writing when he talked about when he wrote Neuromancer. He was like, he's trying to write it in such a way that you'd never give anyone time to be bored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when I was trying to learn how to write, that was always a phrase of his that I really loved that I thought, wow, yeah, that's exactly the sort of thing I love when I read too. But on the other hand, I have this weird sort of like multicultural background, you know, which is important. So it's this, you know, this infusion of, you know, really interesting diversity with lots of action and adventure and high concepts going on at the same time. You know, for me, it was always like, you know, what if James Bond hadn't have been this, like, you know, stuck-up, upper-class-sounding British spy, and had been, like, you know, instead of, like, him coming to the Caribbean and solving something, you know, how much cooler would it have been if, like, you know, we had some sort of, like, you know, guy with dreadlocks who was, like, an awesome kick-ass spy, you know, solving the problem in the Caribbean and saving the world, you know? Yep. That was the sort of thing that I was like, you know, this is what
we need. The non-imperialist view.
Right, right. Yeah. So this, you know, Jay Lake was one of the first people who said Toby Wright's post-colonial action adventure. You know, mm-hmm. And I was kind of like, all right, yeah, I'll take that. I like that.
That's good. That's a very good phrase.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that very much, you know, is kind of what I'm doing. I want to take these Caribbean heroes, but write this larger than life. You know, fun stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, you know, are always kind of like, oh, I don't want to read something that, you know, is multicultural. There's this sort of like, oh, it feels like it's going to be like, I'm going to be preached at, it's not going to be fun.
It's a word that has been abused.
It has been.
And it has been used by people that want to be didactic and have a political purpose. Not that we on WBAI are ever political, God help me. But, you know, the idea that so many of my colleagues will praise Octavia Butler, I wonder how many of them have read her and realized, hey, this is really good stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
It's like there's a good adventure here.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of my inspiration, is that I really want to first and foremost entertain, but also, you know, bring in this post-colonial multicultural ethic and mm-hmm. and see, you know, nautical, you know, as well. You know, I'd say about a third of my stuff is focused on that, you know, post-colonial Caribbean aspect. A third of it is, you know, got these nautical overtones, and a third of it's just whatever the hell strikes my fancy at the
yeah.
time that, you know, has me sort of, you know, brimming with interest.
And so be zeitgeist.
Right, you know,
yeah.
and so I kind of thread all this stuff in, and sometimes there's stuff that's going on about the Caribbean in a work that doesn't even look like or have any references, you know,
mm-hmm.
Things that I'm thinking about. And so this all comes together, and mostly that's you know, I'm trying to, you know, infuse that. But yeah, like that mission statement I have is that I really want, you know, people to kind of, like, I had one reader who told me, he wrote a review of my first book, and he's like, you know, I've been avoiding this book for years, because when someone told me it was multicultural science fiction, I was just kind of like, I don't want to read that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then he's like, and I really regret not having read this 3 years ago, because he's like, this was a kick-ass adventure, you know?
Yeah, the only advantage to that is, because we're dealing with a trilogy at this point,
right,
is that you can read it all at once.
Boom, boom, boom. Yes,
yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And I do enjoy that. And occasionally I will get a book that will say on it, the first in the whatever. And that goes on the not immediate read pile. That goes on the read when book two comes
out
pile. So I can gobble them up together. I do that with television series also and things like that. So I can enjoy the serial aspect in a brief period of time.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I don't watch regular TV anymore. I have, you know, the streaming Netflix subscription, so
mm-hmm.
I can just, or I order them by, you know, DVD, so I can just, like, watch them all without.
Yeah, that's my favorite way of doing it. I use DVRs to the same purpose, and also Netflix and other means.
Yep, yep.
Utilizing technology in order to grab things in serial order.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's my preferred way of
consuming. It's a shame they don't do more of that. But there is an awareness, I would say, in programmers now that people like that because of the entire on-demand concept of digital television.
I'll be really interested to see when we get our first on-demand only TV show that's very good.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, we'll see. I think there are plans, although they still release them serially. So they have the entire on-demand thing, but they don't put out all the episodes at once, or even one day after the other.
Right.
Book publishers haven't really picked up on that either.
The
idea of putting out, Naomi Novik's first three books. They were 1 month after, I think it was Naomi.
Yeah,
in the Temeraire series.
Yep. Yeah.
Del Rey, I think it was.
Charles Finley, under C.C. Finley, his Demon Redcoat series also came out in this similar manner.
Yeah, yeah. So there has to be some kind of 19th century connection, I guess, for Napoleonic connection for publishers to get that idea. But yeah, that's a wonderful thing, and I love it. I eat it up that way so that I can just go from one book to the next.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're hoping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, those publishers who have tried it have been rather successful.
I think so, yeah.
Because it seems that with all of those series, when they do that, they're saying, okay, that worked, we're ordering more in that same series. But of course, now they have to wait for, the writer is like, what?
Yes.
So.
Well, yeah, getting three books ready all at once for that takes some time.
Yeah, and I don't remember when the first Temeraire book came out, but the sixth is coming out in a few months.
Okay.
So, Naomi she's at it.
Yeah.
Who would you say are your contemporaries today in the speculative fiction realm? So, or not? Just which writers would you like to stand amongst?
Amongst?
Yeah.
Oh,
if you read me, you'll also want to read.
Well, there's a cohort of writers that I've kind of come up with, and entered the field with. And of course, we mentioned Charles Coleman Finley as one of my peers, I'm a huge fan of him as both a person, human being, and a writer. Paul Melko is another. Paolo Bacigalupi, he's someone that I really... he's someone that I've been shoving at everyone, and, I'm honored to call him a friend as well. Carl Schrader is another friend of mine who, worked on a short story together that was in The Year's Best, and that was because someone asked me, who would you most like to write, co-write a story with? And I was like, Carl! And
when you say The Year's Best, there are always a few. Which Year's Best?
Mr. Kramer's.
Okay. Because Hartwell Kramer, Dozois, whoever Dozois is working with, and there's the Datlow. They're about 4 or 5 years best, and they're all good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was originally published by Lou Anders in Fast Forward 2, where we got it.
But the Hartwell is sort of like the definitive Year's Best of the modern era.
Well, we were pretty psyched to have it in there, working with Carl was a real pleasure, and he's definitely someone who, the first time I met him, it was one of those things where I was like, we were on a panel together, and we had so much fun talking that I kind of afterwards just kind of followed him around like, you're going to be my new best friend. You may fight it for a while, but it's going to happen. I think you're just the coolest person. some other writers who are doing some other great stuff. I always feel guilty because I don't leave anyone out.
Yeah, I know. It's a problem.
A lot of Ohio writers I'm very close to. So you got like Chris Barzak, out there. Karen Loachi is someone who I got to know when I was coming into the field who was doing some really cool stuff. Still is. Her Gaslight, she's got this, it was Gaslight Dogs is the name of her next novel that's coming out. I can't wait to read it.
It's a great title. I don't know her work. I'll have to correct that.
And just lots of,
Now, what's interesting is it seems to me that much of what you are typing and certainly much of what you're writing is specifically on the science fiction side of spec fic, less so than the fantasy side.
Yes.
Which is interesting, again, with the Caribbean connection, where the fantasy would... and Nalo, too, is also doing mostly science fiction. Well, if you think of...
She started out with the science fiction. She's moved more into sort of the fantasy and magical realism.
But she started with Brown Girl in the Ring, and Night Robber.
Right.
Those were all, strictly science
fiction. Right.
And I just find it... So what is it about the science fiction that...
Well, I have this thing where there's a tremendous lack of diversity in some visions of the future. I was just telling someone...
We could go on about that, yeah.
Yes, we could. The other day I said, they asked me if I saw the new Star Trek, and if I enjoyed it. And I said, yes, I did enjoy it. I was very excited to see it. You know, I could, you can quibble about plot, you can quibble about world building, but it was an entertaining movie.
Yeah.
But the thing that depressed me about watching it was I realized that it was probably the most diversely cast science fiction movie, or even diversely cast piece of literature, mm-hmm. that I'd seen that year. And this was a remake of a series that was originally cast in 1960.
That's right. Oh, well, 66, yeah.
Right. So I'm like, okay, that's really depressing. You know, if you really kind of wrap your head around that.
Yeah. Of course, one should point out that was part of the multicultural aspect, shall we say, was part of Roddenberry's goal.
Which was brilliant.
To begin with.
Evolutionary and revolutionary, all of those things.
But the fact is, we haven't been able to top Gene. Yeah.
We haven't been able to top them.
And
the only reason this movie had that much diversity in it is because they had to...
They had to do it because of Roddenberry. That's right.
And that kind of chapped my butt a little bit, to be honest with you. Because once I sat there and thought about that, I thought, you know what? That's really frustrating to me.
This is an area in which British series television is ahead of the curve.
Vastly, yes. And so it is a nascent frustration I had, which was that, you know, the world I saw, it was not being very reflected in science fiction. The world as it's going to be. I mean, if you simply read the U.S. Census projections of what America will look like in the 20, 30 years from now, you know, how can we justify writing these stories that are so painfully white?
Mm-hmm.
Not that there's anything wrong with, you know...
Ain't nothing wrong with it. It's just that there's a lot more to the world.
Right. You know, speaking as someone who also laments the fact that science fiction has... not even created another Clifford Simak in 30 years, as we've all sort of become more urbanized. And so that's another area of science
fiction. Thank you for mentioning his name.
Point
he's
out,
a favorite of mine.
He's a fantastic writer, but we don't have many...
I got to interview him.
That would be really cool.
What a thrill. No, I did.
Yeah.
I drag out that tape every few years. I'll play it again soon. I like to go through my... They're not here now, but I've got the tape.
Okay.
So.
But yeah, so there's these aspects of science fiction that are now being, you know, underserved. And you know, it's that perennial question of where are the brown people in our vision of the future? And you know, like... some friends of mine have said, you know, like, what, you know, like, was there some mass holocaust and they all disappeared, or, you know, like, what has happened that they've all just kind of like up and left? And so, you know, all joking aside, it became something that I wanted to do was to write fiction that incorporated more diversity,
mm-hmm.
you know, without being, you know, without hammering anyone on the head about it, but saying that, look, this can be fun. This doesn't have to be hard. You know, it isn't that hard to include more characters of diversity in your fiction. You know, we can all do it, and it can be amazingly awesome.
And being science fiction, you're supposed to be able to look outside your immediate circle.
Right, right.
And extrapolate.
Right. If we're willing to talk about, you know, aliens, you know, we should also be willing to tackle, you know, other human beings. You know, it's not... You know, it's not that hard of a stretch. You know, you can't justify, you know, what you... It's just, you know... It's hard to justify, like, you know, taking a mulligan on that. And so it's like, and even just people's, you know, projections of the future, you know, it's just like, they're going to be a lot more diversity. There's going to be a lot more diversity. And I think it's America's strength. I think it's one of the most amazing, awesome things about America is the fact that, you know, for one thing, I mean, a lot of people don't realize that other countries are struggling with diversity issues,
mm-hmm.
you know, just because... China, for example, say is full of lots of Chinese people, doesn't mean it's diverse or has a diverse, strengthened background, right? And so, like, we have this amazing, amazing history that is troubled, but we're willing to lay it open and probe at it and try and figure out how to become better. And it's one of the reasons I am a fan of Western society is that we have Torontos and New Yorks
mm-hmm.
and places like that. Where we're you know, we're, it's not perfect. It's been a really bumpy, you know, period, and we're always still learning. But the fact that, you know, in so many cases that we've committed to trying to figure out how to live together, lots of us in lots of different ways, I think, is no matter what the world slings at America, the fact that it's so diverse is a very encouraging thing. And... you know, that's one of the things I do love about my adoptive country. And so being able to take what I think is one of the really cool features of America and bring it into the fiction, which is that we can be diverse and we can be more diverse, and try to bring that voice to science fiction, I think is important, because science fiction is about the future. And if we're not, if we don't have more diverse authors, and if we don't have more diverse characters, then we're really not talking about the future anymore. We're talking about some bizarre frozen form of the past that no longer is pertinent. And so I think in order for science fiction to remain relevant, we need more of this.
Yeah, and it is starting to happen.
It is starting.
It's only starting to happen.
It is starting to happen.
The ice is breaking.
It is.
And the number of people coming out of Clarion today are a much, not the number, but the diversity of people coming out of Clarion today is much greater than it was even in your year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that your year was the year that, for example, Cherie Renee Thomas was coming out, and she created the Dark Matter series.
Right.
And things like that, so that we still haven't seen a major breakthrough in Asian culture in the English language.
Let's say Ted Chiang certainly represents.
Oh, there's one.
But yeah,
Watch out for
Tony Pai. He's a young up-and-comer who's doing some really good stuff. And he just did this anthology called The Dragon and the Stars.
Okay.
That I would highly recommend.
Oh, and John Joseph Adams was on my show about 3 weeks ago. We played a story of his.
Okay.
From an audiobook, but I didn't even realize, well, I didn't think about what Tony Pai's background is. He and I, in fact, have been corresponding through email.
Okay.
But, you know, that's the thing about virtual.
Well, yeah, online, yeah.
No, that's really the wonderful knows. Thing about virtual. Is you don't know who they are till you meet them.
Yep. Well, and so there's more diversity happening. I actually think that due to the internet, more diverse authors are starting to be able to find each other and you know that there is a place being built. You know that there is definitely, and particularly among a lot of the online and younger magazines, seems to be very active in hunting out diversity, which is really good.
And
okay, there's about another 4 minutes to that interview, but we're going to cut it off, partly because it's largely just after that point small talk, and I want to get to the reading. There's a very brief reading that Toby Bukel did. Later that day at the New York Review of Science Fiction last month. And let's get right to it. Introducing him is guest curator Joe Monti. And he will talk a little bit. He had talked a little bit about his history of the series, but, you know, time considerations and all that. Let's get directly to his introduction of Tobias S. Bukel.
On that little note, we'll start off with Toby Bukel. Tobias is, and I'll give a little bio because it's significant to his fiction. He was born in the Caribbean, actually in Grenada. He went around the islands as he was growing up, living on a boat, and started writing at 5 or 6 years old. He read Childhood's End, and that's what got him started in science fiction, both that age sense of wonder and escapism, too, that us readers all love. His first short story, What Science Fiction Age, and let's see, Campbell Award nominee? I'm forgetting, right? Yes, and also a Writers of the Future Award winner, and he's since done 3 novels with Tor, as well as a Halo novel. Is credited as the editor of the Encyclopedia for Halo, and has another novella, and is almost done with a YA science fiction novel, which kicks butt. He's got a wonderful web presence, and was integral in part of the conversation on Amazon Fail versus Macmillan, you know, recently. Amazon Fail 2.0, if you're counting. And without further ado, Tobias Bukel.
Yeah.
Well, the story I'm going to read is it's a little piece I really like to read because I like to do short readings. I don't like to overstay my welcome. And it's based on basically that background. One of the things I always get into online and in personal space sometimes is this idea of why non-American nations should engage in the space program, or in fact, why should people like from the Caribbean be interested in space? And it's a question I actually set out to try and answer in a story that I wrote for Nature magazine, which was really cool. And it was the first time, at the time I was working for a small liberal arts college out in Ohio, and who paid absolutely no real attention to me whatsoever in terms of my out of work endeavors. And it was very funny that when it came out in Nature magazine, which the entire science department does actually pay very close attention to. And the entire science department suddenly sort of showed up outside my office one day and was kind of like, did you actually write this? Is this you're saying? Are you Tobias? Yes. this is one of those nice little ego boo moments where you're kind of like, yes, I am actually published in somewhere real that you may pick up occasionally. So this is called Toy Planes. And I shall begin. My sister Joni's deft hands flicked from dreadlock to dreadlock, considering her strategy. "You're always leaving," she said, flicking the razor on, and suddenly I'm five, chasing her with a kite made from plastic bags and twigs, shouting that I was going to fly away from her one day. "I'm sorry," I said. "Please, let's just get this done." I'd waited long enough. I'd grown the dreads because when I studied in the U.S., I wanted to remember who I was and where I came from as I began to lose my Caribbean accent. But the rocket plane's sponsor wanted them cut. It would be a disaster for a helmet not to have a proper seal in an emergency, they said. Explosive decompression was not something a soda company wanted to be associated with in their customers' minds. It was insulting that they assumed we couldn't keep the craft sealed, but we needed their money. The locks had become a big enough part of me that I winced when the clippers bit into them, groaned, and another piece of me fell away to the ground. In the back of the bus that I had picked me up, I hung onto a looped handle that swung from the roof as the driver rocketed down the dirt road from Joni's house. My sister had found a place out in the country, a nice concrete house with a basement opening up into the sloped garden on the side of a steep hill. She taught mathematics at the school a few miles away, an open shuttered building, and this would have been my future too, if I hadn't have been so intent on getting off the rock. The islands always call their children back, however. We hit asphalt, potholes, and past cane fields with machete-wielding laborers hacking away at the stalks, sweat-drenched shirts knotted around their waists. It was hot. My arms stuck to the plastic-covered seat. The driver leaned into a turn and looked back at me. "I want to ask you something," he said, and I really wished the back seats had seat belts. "Sure," I said. "All that money you spend, and you don't think it better spent on getting better roads," he said, as he dodged a pothole, "or more school funding. Why not keep it down here?" Colorful red and yellow houses on stilts dotted the steep, lush ground mountainsides as I look out the tinted windows. "Only a small part of the program got funded by the government," I explained. "We found private investors, advertisers, to back the rest, and whatever the government invested will be repaid." "Maybe," he said. Now, I had extra arguments. How many people lived on the island? Tens of thousands? Most of our food was imported, leaving us dependent on other food-producing nations, who all use satellites to track their farming. What spin-off technologies might come out of studying recycling in space? Why wait for other nations to get to it first? Research always produced good things for the people who engaged in it. But I was tired of arguing for all that, and I only had sound bites for him, the same sound bites I'd given the media who treated us all like kids trying to do something all grown up. The market surrounded me in a riot of color, fruit, vegetables, full women in dresses, and bright floral patterns. And around me the noise of hundreds of people constantly bargaining over the things like the price of fish. Teenagers stood around the corners with friends. I wandered all around looking for something, as we needed to fill the craft with enough extra weight to simulate another passenger, and I still had a few extra ounces to spend. I found a small toy stall, and standing in front of it, I was 5 years old again, with no money and a piece of scrap metal in a triangular shape, shaped like a space plane. I used to pretend this was just like the real-life ones I'd read about in the books donated to my school after the hurricane, and at night, when the power would sometimes flicker out, I'd go out and stand on the porch and look at the bright stars up ahead and envy them. The stall had a small bottle, hammered over with soda can metal, triangular welded on wings, and a cone stuck to the back. It was painted in yellow, black, and green, and I bought it. The rest of that day was a real blur for me. Getting to the field involved running the press. Yes, I'd cut my hair for safety reasons. Yes, I thought this was a good use of our money, not just for first world nations deserved space. It was hair for everybody.
There are photos of me getting aboard the tiny rocket plane with a small little brown package under my arm. The giant balloon platform that the plane hung from shifted in the gentle, salty island breeze, and not too far away the waves hit the sand of the beach. Inside, suited up, the door closed, everything became electronic. It was the cheapest way to get to orbit. Balloon on up on a triangular platform to save on initial fuel, then light the rocket plane up and head for orbit. We'd scavenged balloons and material from several companies, one that had been once used by a Chinese corporation during trials, and the guidance system was, of course, all open source. Online betting parlors had our odds at 50%. We weren't even the first, but we were the first island to try this. The countdown finished, my stomach lurched, and I saw palm trees slide by the portholes to my right. I reached back and patted the package where the hammered together little toy space plane was inside, and smiled. "Hello out there, all of you," I whispered into the radio as I rose. "We're coming up too." So, thank you very much. That's Toy Planes.
Wow. Disappointingly short, but a good story. Tobias S. Bukel, again, is the writer that you've been listening to all this morning. That's B-U-C-K-E-L-L. And this program that you've been listening to is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM in New York and at WBAI.org in the rest of the known and occasionally unknown universe. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning, Jim.
And this morning on As I Please,
Raisin Hell.
Raisin Hell.
Well, Raising Hell. Dante.
Oh, Raising.
Raising Hell.
Hell. Okay, very, very good. There is some kind of Dante-based video game that I'm just not looking at.
I saw a bit of it online, and I can tell you right now, it has very little relation to the book.
You think? You think? Yeah. It belongs in its own circle, doesn't it?
Yeah, the circle of disrespect to great poets.
Yeah, although there was something good about Dante that I saw not long ago. I don't remember what
Dante's
exactly
Inferno?
It was. Yeah, yeah.
The
The Divine Comedy.
The Sandow Burke film.
That's that animated film.
Yeah, it's really good.
It is bizarre. I enjoyed watching it, but
I did not expect to enjoy it, but I really had a great
time. But it actually is relevant.
It's a well-done little piece.
Yeah, it
like,
is.
Like Monarch Notes, it's not a substitute for the original, but it's a nice
Yeah, it runs an ovation a great deal for those who are looking for it. Whenever they go into their animation kick, which they do about every 3 months, they tend to run that and How to Draw a Bunny and a few other interesting animation documentaries and examples of animation. The commercials they run, Ovation used to be non-commercial, and then it was bought by the Weinsteins and they made it commercial, but they're running the same damn programs that they just have these, you know, party line sex ads in the middle, the really low end.
One of the great things about cable, you know, that if you missed it, it'll always come around again.
Well, there's
and
that.
And again.
Well, it depends on the cable station, but Ovation is like that. But Ovation is, you know, sort of does some of the programming that Bravo did when Bravo was good.
What's the Ovation slogan?
Oh, I've forgotten. I think they've changed it.
I know sci-fi or SF is...
Siffy.
Imagine better.
Yeah, we call it Siffy because... Because of the spelling. S-Y-F-Y? Come on. Yeah. It's the syphilis channel.
Exactly.
And it has very, very little to do with science fiction, although... what is it? Oh, yes. They're running Merlin Series 2 in their 10 o'clock Friday night slot, which is really, you know, has nothing to do with Arthurian literature, but it's really great junk.
Okay.
It's a lot. Tony Head is in it. He plays Uther Pendragon.
I see that it's rerun a lot, so one of these days I'll catch an episode.
Oh, this is first run.
They have like a days of...
Are you talking about Dante or
no, Merlin.
Oh, no, that was first run. That was first run.
Weeks of bringing you up to date with the
That was first run. I was on NBC last year.
That's right.
During the summer. And then this was first run on the Syphilis
Channel.
Jay
Leno played Merlin in that, right?
Yes, that's the one. That's the one. But no, that was never run before on Syphy and may or may not be run again. I mean, it's owned by NBC, so that's why they ran it. Now they're running Series 2 for the first time. But that's all irrelevant because tonight, Doctor Who begins. The fifth series starring Matt Smith as the Doctor. Will he be any good? Well, they'll know in England tonight, and we'll find out in, I guess, 2 weeks is when it premieres here. Next week on this program, the editors of an online anthology, Thought Crime Experiment. What a great title. And what an interesting anthology. It's sort of like the online version of speculative fiction, the Whole Earth Catalog, the way they're running it. I mean, it's very, very interesting. And the people who are doing it are very interesting. And there's a fun story of how I met them and all that. Well, tune in next week to find out. Week after that? Oh, I'm not sure. And then Sam Butler, S.C. Butler, will make his annual April appearance on this program. It happens every spring. We have a tendency to discuss a lot of baseball, you see. So, you know, that title does have to come up, doesn't it? Okay, so let's see. Just a half a minute left. So, I'm not even going to say visit ourwolf.com because it's so out of date. But actually, there's a lot of good information on ourwolf.com, and you can go there and see it or, friend me on Facebook or follow me on Twitter, all that kind of stuff like that there. It's always available, and Chris Dykman has redesigned my website, so it'll be up to date soon. So ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R. Oh, yes, and of course, this Tuesday at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, our next reading with three, Robin Wasserman, Barry Liga, and Marie Rutosky, three fine young adult novelists. A do-not-miss episode, 138 Sullivan Street, 6:30, admission by donation or free if you can't give a donation. Hope to see you there. And in the meantime, stay tuned for As I Please with Simon Lokely and enjoy yourselves. Good Pesach and whatever the other holidays are this week. Take care. Good morning. Love will win.
Release the Kraken! I've been seeing this advertisement for this a movie called Clash of the Titans for weeks now. Yeah, I need not tell you, now in 3D. Now, I don't really quite understand why anyone would want to remake The Clash of the Titans, but there is this one, to be an actor, and to get an opportunity to say a line like this, Release the Kraken! Why, that is worth living for. And good morning, and hello, and welcome to As I Please, Release the Kraken! Welcome to As I Please, for this, the third day of April, in the year 10. And good news for someone, we think. The former Soviet Union has announced a plan to reform their prison system. And frankly, we hear a lot about reform. Now, don't remember when everyone was talking about electoral reform? Periodically, even in these United States, there are people talking about prison reform, school reform, 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 tea reform. And so it seems that the bug has hit the former Soviet Union. And reading up on the Soviet Union prison system, the gulags, as we used to call them, I was astonished at just how backward it all is. Now, the New York Times, which is the source for this information, says that there's about 800,000 prisoners in the former Soviet Union, spread through something like 750 penal colonies. The very phrase, penal colony, is enough to send a shiver down one's spine, is it not? And in these prison colonies, in this gulag system, the prisoners are confined to barracks. Yes, the cell block, which has been really the standard of prisons for so long, is unknown in the former Soviet Union, though prison reformists are saying, I think that's the way, that's the route we're going to follow. We're going to start building up cell blocks. Now, the details of this just goes to show you that there's always things that could be worse, and being in the former Soviet Union prison system does not sound like a picnic. Kirill A. Karnuzhin, a boyish 37-year-old inmate serving 10 years for growing ganja in his Moscow apartment. Well, they can make one step of reformation in the former Soviet Union prison system. Release the potheads. They don't need to be in a gulag now, do they? He says that when he arrived at his camp, makes it sound so sweet, right? Oh, we're all going off to camp for a while. He was immediately greeted by a former, well, by a career criminal, a former boxer, who basically beat the crap out of him. The Times says that these sort of acts of violence are quite common in the former Soviet Union prison system. And let's see, the caste system of prison. There are four basic groups within the former Soviet Union prison society. One, the degraded. They are at the bottom of the pile. And the degraded do menial chores like cleaning bathrooms and fetching cigarettes and bending over upon occasion. Men convicted of child molestation and former policemen immediately enter the degraded group. The boxer, a repeat offender and a member of an ethnic criminal gang, belong to the group at the top, the thieves-in-law known as the authorities. Inmates known as activists, which perhaps will give a new sense to the term activist that you hear over Pacifica. Inmates known as activists worked with correction officers to enforce order and make up a second privileged class. They have been organized into formal discipline and order squads, but those discipline and order squads were disbanded in January as part of the reform movement. And the rest are simply known as the men or the guys. And, well, there's just your basic prisoner. Well, I guess one of the disturbing things here is that it does seem to indicate that this kind of class system may almost be considered natural to humanity. That here in this contained society, these levels of authority are at once set up. There is also the sense that the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, has a long history of really crappy prisons. So I welcome the news that they are intending to reform. And yet, I have me doubts. But I always have me doubts. Of course, the same week we heard that, 800,000 prisoners in the former Soviet Union prison system. At one sense, that seems a lot. The other sense, I'm surprised. I mean, somehow, I would have thought more. But I guess it all depends on what is the population of the former Soviet Union. But in China, we hear that China leads the world in executions. So there you go. You know, you can go to a crappy prison, but no death penalty. Or you can go to a modern state-of-the-art prison in China. State-of-the-art, indeed. And be summarily executed with a pistol shot to the brain. The PRC, the People's Republic of China, leads the world in executions with over 700. Hold a minute. Let me get that figure right. Oh, there it is. Ah, here it is. Approximately 1,700 people were executed in China in the year 2008. The world executions are after China, followed by Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. So I guess it's a moment of pride for us, where we could say we may not be number one, but we are in the top five when it comes to just sheer brutality. We're up there in the higher echelons. And I suppose this is the great difference between the People's Republic of China and these here United States of America. In the United States, you get convicted and sent to prison, and you might be given that great career opportunity of making license plates. And as a friend of mine points out, imagine being a prisoner in New Hampshire, stamping day in and day out, live free or die. And by the way, I will just announce right now that I am not entirely sure that prisoners actually make license plates. I think that might just be an example of sort of the pointless work which they are forced to engage in. But if they do make license plates, it really doesn't sound like a career that you can take on with you into the free world. But in the People's Republic of China, although there is an increasing demand for license plates, as we all know, the fact of the matter is, if you're in prison in the PRC, you'll have an opportunity to find a spot in the bodies exhibition that is opening near you. Yes, opening at a mall near you.